You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Seven minutes after 8 o'clock, hour two commences, joined from New Jersey by one of the tough guys from New Jersey, Jack O'Ban. Jack, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Not that tough.
It's a state trait. One of my favorite things, and it's kind of a segue into the segment here, is this song was playing in the barbershop in Fallujah when I walked in. And the Turkish barbers that had been contracted to come down there and cut hair were Kylie Minogue fans. And this thing played over and over and over, right? And so I'm sitting there, and the barber looks at me, and he says, at the end of the haircut, he says, "Do you want the flame?" Now, there's all these Marines in the barbershop, right? Now, I just got there, right? Do I want the flame? Right, there's all these Marines there. Yeah, hell yeah, I want the flame. I mean, can I have two of them? I don't even know what the flame is, right? But in the macho fest that is the Marine Corps, right? Do I want the flame? Like, yeah. So what the flame turns out to be is this straightened out safety pin, no, paperclip, right, with a cotton ball at the end stuck into an alcohol bottle. And then he pulls it out, he lights it on fire, and then he burns the small hairs on your ears and behind your neck and things like that. That was the flame. But that's not the funny part of the story. The funny part of the story is, in front of all these people in macho land, do you want the flame? I'm like, well, yeah, hell yeah, I want the flame. Like, cause I can't not take the flame in front of all these other Marines. I gotta take it. I gotta be it, right? So I want to have you on. I'm enjoying tremendously this conversation about leadership at the point of confrontation, and what makes a difference between people standing up and people not. And I just got talked to Tom Girardi for about 45 minutes about it. And I played a little clip of General Zinni talking about when he went to be a company commander in Vietnam. He flew over with a lieutenant who came to his company. And the lieutenant, as he's checking in that day, Zinni's kind of eavesdropping, and he tells the staff sergeant, "I want to inspect rifles tomorrow." Right? What you're supposed to do when you take over a platoon. And the staff sergeant says, "Hey, lieutenant, this is Vietnam. We don't do that." And Zinni said, "Here's the moral challenge, right? Here's the experienced guy telling him, what you learn doesn't know. We know." And he said, the lieutenant, though, he said, he's a good officer. He said, no. He said, "I want to do it." And so the next morning, Zinni said, I kind of hid behind a sea hut to see what would happen. He said, the lieutenant gets to about the fifth weapon, and he looks at the staff sergeant, and he says, "These things are filthy. I thought you told me, you know, you kept them clean. This is combat." And the staff sergeant said, "I didn't know it was going to be some kind of boot camp, you know, inspection." And he said, so from the get-go, this lieutenant, and he said, and he did great because he didn't flinch. And then Zinni said two other things in that company. I saw a Marine pull off his cover, and there were scalps in it. And then I saw a Marine showed me a picture, kind of laughing, shaky. He said, "Check this out." And it was mutilated bodies. He said, in both cases, I grabbed the cover. I told him to burn it. I said, if I ever see that or hear about that again, you'll get court-martialed. And he said, and with the picture, I ripped it up, and I said, I don't ever want to see this again. If I ever see a camera doing any of this stuff, He said, I'll have your ass. And he said, you know what? In both cases, you know what I got back from the Marines? Not a look of hate. He said, I swear. He said, I got a look of relief.
Relief. Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
So I wanted to have you on today and talk about that point of confrontation and the role that fighting plays in that, and I mean physical confrontation plays in that. Because if somebody just stands up and when I say, "Hey, Hoban, I'm not doing that," and you say, "Oh yeah, you are, Mac," and I say, "I'm not. Look, do you want to go?" If we fight about it, chances are those events don't happen. At least that's my opinion. I think
chances are the fight never happens either.
Okay, so talk to me about, and this goes back to Robert Humphreys, right? I love the story you tell when you say you met him and he was sizing you up in that class. And then, you know, he introduced himself as being a platoon commander on Iwo Jima. Like, oh, I love that.
I better reevaluate my first impression.
Will you tell that real quick about meeting him? Because so much, again, I know his kids. I know his kids. And even his daughters, he taught to box.
Oh, his daughter, yeah.
Because he believed in this physical confidence. Right, along with moral courage, set you on the path of living a better life.
Well, one of the things he told me was that when he was on Iwo Jima, and you know, you first start getting the rounds coming down on you from downrange, you know, a lot of the guys would freeze. It wasn't that they were cowards; they were just like totally overwhelmed by the experience.
Right,
and he wasn't. And afterwards, he thought about it. He says, how come I wasn't, and most of the guys were? But there were a few guys that weren't. And the thing that he realized was the guys that overcame the stress the quickest were the guys that who were the boxers. The guys who had the in-the-face stress from getting hit in boxing matches. The guys that had boxed and had that experience overcame the stress of firefights faster than the guys that hadn't. And he just started to connect the dots. He said, you know, this physical self-confidence does a couple things. One, it helps you to overcome the stress of violence in combat. So what he would do is he would take the guys that weren't experienced fighters, take them off the line and slap fight with them on the beach. Until they would fight back, get pissed off and fight back. And then he could take them back on the line and they would shoot. They weren't shooting before. But when he slapped for them and made them fight back, and they got used to that in-the-face stress, they were more effective shooting when they get back to the line. The second thing that he told me was that there's a connection. He doesn't know exactly what it was, but there was a connection between physical courage and moral courage, and it was like if a person was confronted with a moral challenge, and that's what we're talking about here. You know, you right. see a Marine harassing a female, or you see a Marine over drinking and trying to get in his car, or the extreme examples of a Marine preparing to commit an atrocity. In combat or in a combat situation, it takes a lot of moral courage to go up to this guy, particularly if you've, you know, been in combat with him or you've saved each other's lives or you've been in the same unit and have a lot of experiences. To go up to him and says, hey, dude, give me those car keys. Or, hey, you know, you're supposed to be a protector. You know, we don't talk to women like that. You got to be kidding me. Or, hey, dude, no, we are not taking this prisoner behind the berm. we're just not doing that. And the guys that have physical self-confidence seem to be able to speak up in situations that require moral courage as well. I don't know why. I'm not sure why that is. I mean, I'm not a scientist. I just know that if you're not afraid to just go up and say, look, don't do that, and the guy says, oh, what, you're going to make me, or you're going to stop me, or something like that, and you know that maybe, you know, you're not some 15th degree black belt or something like that, but you know that you can give a shot and take a shot and go, yeah, I am going to stop you. Let's go. And that physical self-confidence, and it's not a matter of beating somebody up or winning a fight even, it's just knowing that you could take a shot and give a shot just to stop something bad that's going on. You may even lose the fight, but you'll stop what's going on. And that physical self-confidence, we just believe, and my experience shows, and the anecdotal evidence is that if you have the physical courage, it kind of leeches over into moral courage. Not sure why, but that's what we think.
Had you made that connection before you met Mr. Humphrey?
Well, I it's one of those things that happens kind of afterwards. You know, I remember a situation where, you know, a friend of mine was about to get into a bar fight, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, we're going to get thrown in jail here, right? And, but I didn't want him to go to jail, but I knew I was going to have to protect him at the same time. So, I mean, I thought about it afterwards, and I said, you know what, I had the skill to get him out of there. But I didn't think of it as a moral lesson or anything like that. I thought of it more as I didn't want anybody to get in trouble, including myself. You know, so it wasn't until afterwards where I thought about, well, what's the principle here? The principle here is my job was not to fight this guy's adversary for him. Right?
Right.
My job was to protect my buddy. And it sounds like semantics a little bit, but, you know, it really is kind of a principle. Our job, even as Marines, our job is not to go out and beat up bullies. I mean, there's too many of them. You'll never be done.
You know what's interesting?
Our job is to protect people.
You know, Jack, but those semantics are, I think, incredibly important in this discussion. Because I had General Droughty on last hour, and he talked about turning your back. Let me just read you the little passage. And this is being spoken by a corporal by the name of Malgan Calda, who was a fire team leader in Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. In this incident in Iraq where they took a man out of his home and murdered him. He was acquitted of murder on August 1st, but convicted of conspiracy to commit murder, larceny, and housebreaking. He was freed from the Camp Pendleton brig after being sentenced to time already served and reduced in rank to private. Speaking in his service uniform with his attorney by his side, Malcolm Caldas said he knew the plan was wrong, but his squad mates gave him an out by letting him participate in the kidnapping but not firing his weapon. I didn't want to have anything to do with the killing of the insurgent or whoever it might have been. But at the same time, I was willing to support my guys because I wasn't going to let them go off into the night on their own. Malcolm Caldas said he now regrets he was not more persuasive. The killing took place in the early morning of April 26th, blah, 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 blah. And the dialogue was, I'm not going to do this. What are you, a pussy? And he said, these guys I fought with in Fallujah, I fought with them here now. This is our second deployment. They've saved my life. I've saved their life. There's nobody closer on the planet. And so when you talk about, and General Droughty used the phrase, turn your back on that stuff and walk away. Even that phrase, turn your back on them, I can't do that. So to me, what you just said is, I've got to go save them. And I think that phraseology is important. And I think we're talking about the same thing, but the visual images and the power of loyalty in the Marine Corps, you know, and the bonds that you share with guys, especially guys you fought with and who have saved your lives, when you begin to think of turning your back, it's simply not in the culture. And I think those terms are important. And so, but when you think in terms of saving, which is one of the things I've learned from you, when you think in terms of saving, and I'll fight to save you, okay, but I won't turn my back on you.
Yeah, that's manly. Right. I think, or, you know, marine-like, if you will.
Both.
The other thing that comes to mind in this discussion for me is the clarification of our warrior ethic. I mean, when you ask a Marine what's his core values, he's going to say honor, courage, and commitment. And there's nothing wrong with honor, courage, and commitment, but you got to understand that those are relative values. Believe me, you got Taliban and ISIL who are committed. You got some who are very courageous, and they're always talking about honor.
Right.
So what is the difference between our honor, courage, and commitment and their so-called honor, courage, and commitment? And there's a difference. And that difference is the American core value of an inalienable right to life. And if I were to put it in an axiom, I would say this. There's some great moral values, relative values. And that's what a moral value is. It's a relative value that epitomizes proper human behavior. And that's what honor, courage, and commitment are supposed to do. But no relative value, no moral value, no matter how great, can supersede the life value. And that's the difference between us and them. Their, quote unquote, moral values, their relative values, will supersede the life of anybody that's not in their gang or their tribe. And they've shown that thousands of times. And you could see if a Marine was wounded and captured by them, they'd execute him.
Right.
If we wound and capture an insurgent, what do?
We detain him, we process him,
And he's wounded.
Right.
What do?
Oh, we care for him. We save him.
Yeah, we patch him up, right?
Yeah.
Why? Because all of a sudden now we share his relative values?
No.
We don't share his relative values, but we have a superseding value, that is an inalienable right to life, that we will respect even above and beyond our great moral values. And that, I think, needs to be better clarified for Marines, because it gets so difficult to overcome our relative values of semper fidelis and looking out for each other and all this other kind of stuff, that sometimes, in extreme cases, if it's not properly clarified, it will supersede the life value of people that we don't like because of their behaviors, their relative behaviors. And that's what happens in these isolated cases. Most of the time it doesn't happen. And in the guts of that one Marine who said, I knew it was wrong, he knew it was wrong, but he wasn't clear about it. And he didn't know the other two things that are important. And that is, even though he felt it was clear, he didn't A, know what to say, or B, what to do. And that's where, when we deal with police officers all the time, we teach them three things. Clarify the ethic as protector. And even though these guys have cultures and behaviors and values that you know are immoral, that doesn't give you the right to treat them as subhumans. You still have to respect their lives, even though you have to deal with their immoral behavior. That's clarifying the ethic. The second thing is, you have to learn how to communicate effectively under stress. To say what you mean that's going to be persuasive to get the guy to, in the case of a police officer, give up, or in the case of a fellow Marine, to stop and think about what he's doing before he really makes a mistake. And the third thing is, you have to have physical self-confidence, because as you said, this guy may come and say, well, no, we're taking this guy behind the shed. And you say, no, you're not. And he says, yes, I am. What are you going to do about it? And you say, well, let's go. Right? I'll show you what I'm going to do about it. I'm so focused on protecting you from doing what I know is wrong, and which, by the way, going to ruin your career, because there's very little chance you're not going to get caught doing this kind of thing. But it's not even about your career. It's about doing the right thing, right? About protecting lives. That's what you're here for, to protect lives. Okay?
Right.
I'm going to stop you, and I have the physical self-confidence to do it. And that's why, in McMap, for example, we have, those three pillars, or the three legs of the stool. The character one, the mental toughness and the verbal skills to know what to say, and the physical self-confidence to say, look, even to your friend, hey, I'll kick your ass, buddy. You're not doing that because you're not getting in that car. You're not going to talk to that woman like that. You're not taking that guy behind the berm. I'll kick your ass.
So talk to me about the how significant do you believe that that physical because you and I were talking yesterday. Most guys join the Marine Corps, they've never been in a fight. You know, fighting gets you expelled from school. When we were kids, it got you a big awe. I mean, I went to Catholic school, so we used to fight at the Lutheran churches that were away from our church, right? So we'd go three blocks to the Lutheran church or down the street to the Church of the Good Shepherd. I don't even know what that was, but we'd be behind it fighting with half the school there, you know, watching. It didn't get you kicked out of school. You know, it made you a minor celebrity. But that's no longer our culture anymore. So we've got to teach. How important is that physical confidence, do you think?
Well, let me go off on a tangent here for a second.
The
biggest problem we have right now is the social media, right?
Right.
And the thing about social media is that you can say whatever you want, and it can be as, you know, nice, truthful, and positive as you want it to be, or it could be total lie, disrespectful, trolling crap. But you know what? You don't have to back it up. You can say whatever you want, but, you know, someone says, whoa, what did you just say? You don't say that to me. You shut your mouth. Well, you know, and because there is no physical consequence, somebody coming up to you and saying, hey, shut your mouth, or I'll shut it for you, right?
Right.
Because there's none of that, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And the violence and, you know, that you would not like to see in schools is not going to be stopped by, you know, saying bullies, the bullies and the bullied both are going to get kicked out because we have zero tolerance for it. Because then you'll have no physical self-confidence and no physical skills. But the Marine Corps has the answer. And I know I always sound like a broken record here, but the Marine Corps has an answer. It's called McMap. Properly conducted McMap has all of the pieces that you need. It clarifies the ethic as an ethical warrior, which means a protector of life, okay? It gives you the mental toughness and the verbal skills to speak up. And thirdly, you back it all up with physical self-confidence and physical skills to the point where you may have to, you know, fight your own best friend to save him from getting in the car.
Talk to me about verbal skills. What does all that mean?
Well, at the moment, we don't talk about the verbal skills so much in McMap as we do with the law enforcement.
Okay.
In McMap, the mental or verbal skills are more focused on speaking positively, giving tie-ins, telling stories with moral lessons. That's the verbal piece, you know, where you talk, giving parables, you know, to teach morals through verbal stories.
Right.
We call them tie-ins. You take a story and tie it to a moral lesson that you want the person to get. We do the same with the police, but we also take it another step because police have a lot of de-escalation issues, right? You're dealing with drunks and all this other kind of stuff, and you have to talk them into handcuffs or you have to talk them into, you know, calming down and all this kind of stuff. So we actually use a methodology. It's decades old, called verbal defensive influence, where we teach people what to say when you're trying to persuade somebody to do something, right? So it's actually a formula. Say this first, say that second, say that third, say that fourth. So let's say I'm going up to you, Mac, and I'm saying, hey, Mac, give me your car keys. And you say no. So I'll go to step two. I'll say, hey, the reason I need to have your car keys is I just have been watching you and you just had too much to drink. I tell you what, I'll get you an Uber. Come on, give me your car keys. And you say, no, man, I can drive. Right?
Right.
And then you go to the third step, which is a positive, a negative, and a positive. Okay, look, Mac, give me the car keys. I'll put you in the car. We'll get an Uber, whatever we need to do. We'll get you home safe. The other option is, okay, the other option is I'm going to take the car keys from you, okay? And we're going to be rolling around on the ground here. We're probably both going to get thrown out of here. I don't want that. You don't want that, okay? Doesn't it make more sense just to take an Uber? Give me the keys. Come on, man. And you say, F you. I'm not giving you the keys. I said, look, I've asked you. I told you why. I gave you a couple options, a good one, a bad one, a good one.
Right.
Is there anything I can say to get you to give me the car keys right now? Come on, be a reasonable guy. You know I'm just looking out for you. Do me a favor. Give me the keys right now, will you? It turns out the research says by the fourth time,
oh, really?
By the fourth time, 97% of the time, they'll comply, but it'll take four times for the really bad ones.
Oh, really?
Yep. That leaves 3% where you still tell me to F myself. So you know what? I'm done talking. I'm going to take the frigging keys. I'm going to take them. I'm done arguing with you. And we teach this methodology. It's called verbal defensive influence. I mean, it's kind of an abbreviated version right there, 2 minutes long. But
right.
I mean, and we do it. And they practice these scripts, you know, how to introduce yourself, what to say. When we train Camden Police Department, okay, so you got Camden, which is the most.
Okay, so Jack, just so I know, this is a verbal technique that takes you
verbal
to
verbal de-escalation technique to get to persuade people to do things when they're about to do something that they shouldn't do.
Okay, and so when we look at this in terms of the implementation of I'm going to save you, right? Marines don't let other Marines lead stupid. Okay, I'm trying to think of a phrase like friends don't let friends drive drunk, but Marines don't allow other Marines to
commit atrocities, to drive drunk, to do things that are going to hurt themselves or others because we're protectors.
I like that.
Right.
Well, and you know that word protector is a great word. But this is the verbal escalation of that. Moving towards physical confrontation. And so I think now you can see that, look, the reason why physical confidence is important, the reason why fighting is important, the reason why the phrase, do you want to go, is important, because when they know you're not afraid to go there, right, and they see your confidence, that's going to impact the situation. Certainly.
And you got to be ready to go.
Right.
Remember the second to the last phrase I said, is there anything I can say, Mac, to get you to give me your car keys? I'd like to think so. We've been friends.
Right.
And if you say no, well, then I'm done talking. Because I asked you if there was anything else I could say, and you said there's nothing else you can say. Okay, guess what? I have to act. And I've worked through this process, and I know when talking is over and I got to stop it. I'm going to try to persuade you, right? I'm going to tell you why you should give me the keys. I'm going to give you some other options besides getting yourself a DUI or an accident or hurting somebody. And then I'm going to give you one more chance. And then if you don't give me the keys, or if you don't lay off, you know, harassing that female, or if you think you're going to continue taking this prisoner behind the berm, then you know what? I'm done talking. I'm going to stop you. But I got to know what to do. Uh-oh, I got Joe Shisko calling on the other line.
Shisko, he could...
He's probably...
His skin was
hair standing on the back of his head when he hears me talk like that.
I think, again... and again, the whole black belt thing, I understand it. But to me, it's the confidence thing that you walk away from, not with the moves that if you want to go, I'll go with you. And just that, the effect that
And you may lose the fight.
Is there things
But you know
where,
what? If you have some skill, at least you're not going to look bad when you know, you'll be able to throw a punch. I'm afraid we got Marines, I mean senior Marines, who've never been in a bar fight or something like that, or a school yard brawl, and you know they're afraid they're going to get hurt or get embarrassed, and it's unnecessary. We got McMahon. We'll show you how to do it.
My guest this morning, we're talking about leadership at the point of confrontation. We're talking about the role that fighting plays in this mentality of I'm not afraid to be the leader that I'm supposed to be. I'm not afraid to save you from yourself. My guest is Jack Hoban. He's a former Marine and got out as a captain, was a combat engineer. And is instrumental in the Marine Corps Martial Arts program, and if you Google the phrase ethical warrior, you will see a picture of him, and you'll read a bunch of the stuff he's done with law enforcement, and really I think it's kind of interesting. I think the law enforcement. It's ethical guardian is that's the term you use for.
We used to call them ethical protectors, but now people say guardian or.
Okay.
They don't want to say warrior, obviously. So.
But I think that's kind of the mental image when you're guarding when we're guarding each other. Right, I'm guarding you. I'm protecting you from this thing that you want to do. In every one of these instances, that these marquee leadership failures. If somebody saves people that are in dark places from themselves, this corporal, in two combat deployments, right, risking his life, blah blah blah, winds up in a brig because he did not step forward when his squad leader was being stupid. And seven Marines and Navy corpsmen in that squad were all charged. Their lives and careers essentially, I won't say their lives were ruined, but certainly their careers were ruined. Bad conduct discharges, brig time, all that stuff that begged for. And now we're watching it play out in Parris Island in all these different cases that are coming to light of recruit abuse, whether, Lieutenant Colonel's on being court-martialed now for his failure to act. Gunnery Sergeant going to be court-martialed, who was a senior drill instructor of the recruit that killed himself. In every one of these cases, all of that is prevented if somebody says, ain't happening, you want to go? And so, to me, that's why I want to have Jack on. And do we need to be more of a recreational fighting place? Because when you're around guys that are physically confident, it tends to be, there tends to be, I think, less, patent place and less mystery, because they know with certainty that if it gets sideways, it'll get straightened out. And the culture that I've been around a lot that's like that is the hockey culture. Fighting is the way they settle things, and they all know.
Well, I don't know. Let's not confuse violence as sport. And one of the things that the Marines are different about is, let's face it, we're out there to protect people. Okay, not beat each other up every time we have a disagreement, which is what hockey's turned into now. People don't even watch the game. They're waiting for the fights. I mean, let's not get confused there. What happens with this Marine is we have strong relative values, Semper Fi Alis for each other as Marines, but even those can't supersede the life value of even a prisoner. And that just has to be clarified. And then the second one is, we have to have, leaders sit here and go, okay, if you see something like this, this is what you say. I mean, you want to use verbal defense and influence? I mean, there's five steps to persuade somebody to do something. At the fifth step, either they're going to stop doing it, or you got to go to the next step, which is an action step. And we think, we don't know, we don't have the research behind it, but we think that making these moral stands, particularly against people within your own in-group, right? Guys that you were trained with or in combat with or something like that, takes physical self-confidence. And the only way you can get, there's two ways to get physical self-confidence. You're born with it, because you're a big tough guy somehow,
right.
Or B, you develop the skills, and you can develop the skills through martial arts. That's how you do it. And by the way, I got to go to work, bud. But I give you closing remarks or something like that.
No, go ahead. What I want to do is have you on it. I just think the whole basis of the martial arts program is this physical confidence. Is this physical confidence combined with the moral, and it's the, and again, you every time you come on here, you emphasize, look, it is not, you know, to make you into a kung fu expert. It has very specific aims, and it, I just find it extremely interesting in all these cases that what was lacking, how do we do it, what piece of this is there that is missing. And just interesting leadership study, because everybody faces it. You know, everybody faces it. So I told you I'd keep you to 30 minutes, I think. So anyway, your final comments on these leadership challenges, especially to young guys. I mean, we're older guys that have been studying this for a long time. Mm-hmm. To younger guys, what do you say to them? Don't be afraid?
Well, I think I said it. You got to clarify who are you. Are you a protector, or are you a guy that's going to get run around by your emotions or your feelings? I mean, sometimes you just have to overcome these conflicting emotions and say, I got to go with my gut here. If I feel that it's wrong, then it's probably wrong. I mean, that one Marine said it was wrong, right? He felt it.
Right.
So what's the next step? Well, then I have to say something. What am I going to say? Well, write it down on a piece of paper and practice it in a mirror. Hey, dude, give me your car keys. Or whatever it is that you're going to say, right?
Right.
And the third one is go get yourself some physical self-confidence, you know, PT and in martial arts and things like that. And one of the things that you may have to say, the transition point, as you said, was, okay, man, you're not doing that, and I'm going to stop you. And I love you like a brother, but you're not getting in that car, or you're not going behind that berm, and I'll fight you. And you know what? As you said, there will be relief. It's funny, you used this exact same words that Humphrey did when he was on Iwo Jima. You know, there was guys stomping gold teeth out of Japanese dead and cutting off the ears and stuff like that. And when he stopped it, they were relieved. They were relieved.
You read about that in the old breed, and then you see it in the Pacific. It's gruesome, yep. Gruesome stuff. And, you know, you watch them on Peleliu throw pebbles into somebody's head.
That'll haunt your nightmares, right?
Right. That all that dehumanization and how, yep. You know, those things. And then somebody all of a sudden rescues you from that. And even in the movie Pacific, when Eugene Sledge goes to do it, that kid from New Orleans, God, what's his name? He's got a weird nickname, but anyway.
Yeah. But the doc, I think it was the doc. In real life, it was like the doc or whatever. Say, man, you don't want to do that, man. You know, if that splashes on you, you'll get sick or something like that.
Right, and he doesn't.
Kind of talked about that.
Yeah,
way.
And he saves him. Anyway, all right, sir. First of all, thank you very much.
Talk to you soon. Semper Fi, bro.
Semper Fi. Jack Hoban. Now, I just find this, incredibly interesting discussion vis-a-vis these incidents. You know, I don't find, you know, each component, you know, is interesting. But what I really find interesting is when you layer it down on specific incidents and how people how people react. And it's hard. It's not easy stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to go over some news headlines and a lot of stuff going on right now. The the Attorney General getting ready to testify here shortly about his contacts with Russians. So that's going on today. You have continuing testimony on the DOD budget that's going on today. So that's making news. But we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to we'll come back, check some news headlines. Gunnar join us at the top of the hour as we continue Tuesday Leadership 101. I just think, and I talked to Jack yesterday about this, about, you know, talk to us about, to me about fighting, you know. And it's a confidence thing. There's worse things on the planet than having a sore jaw. But if you have a little bit of confidence that you know that, hey, look, I'm gonna hold my own, and I'm gonna put an end to this. The simple act of the fight itself, you know, no matter the outcome, is to me what's crucial. That you're not gonna back down, and you're not gonna go away, and you're not gonna be a part of it. Ends most of this stuff. So, we'll take a break. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at the Battle Mug, home of the one and only Battle Mug. So, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio on a Tuesday, coming up next on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff, I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org. /Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All Elvis, all the time.
7 lonely days and a dozen pounds ago, I reached out one night and you were gone. Don't know why you'd run, what you're running to or from. All I know is I want to
Kentucky Ring. The King, Elvis. Ooh. Jeff Sessions testifies in a little less than 3 hours. Fox has these countdowns they put on the screen. Like it's a kickoff of the Super Bowl. Anyway. We continue. Read you an email here. Hey, Mac, what is that Zinni thing you played a while ago? I've never heard it. How do I get my hands on it? Send me an email. That's how you get a copy of it. There's one last piece, and I've got to take the tape in to get it converted to digital, because it's a beta tape. Yeah, I had a beta machine when I recorded this, and that's the original recording. So Zinni, I've got about 2 hours of it. And it's hilarious. But he talks, you know, great leadership stuff. And I've given it out for close to 27 years to different people that have asked me for. And so I'll play it again here in a second. But essentially, you know, it's his thoughts on leadership. And it's what he used to do in his officer's school when you came to be part of the 9th Marine Regiment in Okinawa. And everybody, it was at Camp Hansen. You were part of the 9th Marine Regiment. You were supposed to be at officer school. And he taught it. And the reason he taught it was you had to have an idea of what he wanted, if his commander's intent was going to mean anything. How about that? You know, how the hell are they going to know how I think if I don't expose myself to them? Pretty good, you know, hello. So, that is an extract from where he talks about the moral challenges to this. Here's another email. Mac, I never really equated the martial arts program to the things that you're talking about. It would seem to me, given my experience, that there's an over-focus on the kinetic in the martial arts program and a lack of focus on the ethical, you know. I recall, you know, sitting on the side of the circle on sandbags, listening to a lecture by the instructor, but I never really paid most attention to it. I was more concerned with grips and holds, which means I probably was missing the point of the program. I think that's interesting. You'll see a lot of guys doing holds and different things like that as they progress to their black belt. I've enjoyed your discussion. General Drowdy and Jack O'Bam, very different perspectives on it. All pieces in the mosaic. And I enjoy learning and how different people's takes are. The news article you wrote also is pretty pointed. I wonder if you could get him on to talk about it all these years later, or if he's tried to turn the page. You know what? I'm going to try to track him down, LinkedIn, Facebook, something, to see if he'll talk about it. to see if he'll talk about it. Because yeah, I'll tell you, a lot of time, and I do it with, you know, the murder of my two nephews. And that is this. By talking about it, you know, maybe you'll save somebody. And if you save somebody, that means that it wasn't in vain, right? You've used it, you know, you've made lemonade out of lemons. So a lot of people cope with it that way. A lot of people cope with stuff that way. So I'll play that Zinni cut right now. And these are the moral challenges. And what's interesting is, you know, sometimes when you sit, and I think these cases are interesting, but I think, and it goes back to decision making that I used to do. You know, you can throw a little TDG out there, but what's really compelling, and I remember going to Gettysburg the first time I went, and we did kind of a battlefield tour. Wasn't that compelling? It was cool to be on the battlefield and, you know, kind of cool to see where things happened. And this is the wheat field and this is over on top. And to look at them and see where they fought. See the marks that are still there on the battlefield. But then I got interested in decision making. And I thought, you know what would be really interesting is if we went up to Gettysburg and let's look at decisions that they made. Okay. Yeah, that'd be interesting. So I go down this road of looking at three or four decisions at Gettysburg, depending on how much time we have. And what you learned was who the principals were that were going to be involved in these decisions, where they came from, how they were educated, how much experience they had in the war. We then tried to use first-person accounts on both sides relative to the decision that they made. And the Civil War is cool because both sides wrote after the war about their experience. The South, they wrote trying to decide, especially at Gettysburg, was it Lee's fault? Was it Longstreet's fault? Who screwed up on day two? Blah, 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 blah. And so when you give this kind of narrative, this generic narrative of this is what happened, it's not very powerful. And I go back to this story about these Marines. And so so the narrative of what happened in Hamdania in Iraq is way, way, way more riveting than what's come out, okay? Just the story, the generic story. And what I found was the same thing was true at Gettysburg. And so when you're there and you're looking and you put them in the moment and you're looking at original source stuff, and it might be statements from an investigation, and you're putting them in that situation, I think that's the way you have to recreate it for them. And so at Gettysburg, I found, you know, I read a lot, and so I'm reading. Oh man, I'm talking too long. I got to get Mike here, but I'll finish the thought. When you read first person stuff, it comes alive. The experience comes alive. And so I found this letter it's a footnote in Lee's Lieutenants. So I read it and I thought, well, this is the key, because this is the letters from Lee's engineer officer who does the reconnaissance of the Union left flank, which is up towards, which is in the vicinity of Little Round Top on the morning of day two. So they fight on day one. They're at Gettysburg, and now day two is going to start. Okay, and so this is the letter. It's from a captain by the name of S.R. Johnston to General Lafayette McLaws, who's going to write something, relative to Gettysburg. It's written on June 27th, 1892. My rank at the time of the battle was that of Captain of Engineers. I was on the staff of the commanding general. I bivouacked at the headquarters on the night of July 1st. At daybreak in the morning of the 2nd, General Lee called me and said he wanted me to reconnoiter along the enemy's left and return as soon as possible. He said nothing about finding a route over which troops would be moved unobserved by the enemy, but it was not necessary as that was part of my duty as a reconnoitering officer and would be attended to without special instructions. Instead, he said nothing. But do you get the sense of it? It's written with pronouns like I and he, not they and not proper names, as in the third person. It's awesome stuff. It comes alive. It's immersing them in the experience. And so I think without doing that, all of this suffers. All of this suffers, and it doesn't come alive. And I think when you take these instances and you make them come alive, and I don't know that we've done that well enough, that's where true learning starts. That's where true learning starts. And some would refer to it as the case method. Of teaching. It's gone on forever. It has different names. But I will tell you this, first person accounts, if you can get, people discussing it on video, to talk about how conflicted they were at the time. Right? And this corporal in Iraq, they gave him an out. Okay, look, you don't have to kill him. We'll kill him. But you need to come with us. And he said, yeah, no, that's not an issue, I will. And now he talks about, but it's that which you will encounter, that conflicted decision maker. It's not always black and white. It's not always easy. And so, most of the time we're not talking about colonels and generals. We're talking about young Marines trying to make these decisions, trying to figure it out. How do you make them better?